Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW, Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to continue with my guest, Robert Coover, this time entirely about his book, A Child Again, published recently by McSweeney's. It's a collection of short fictions and puzzles and games, and there's even a deck of cards affixed to the back of the book that, shuffled together, can retell and retell a story. And I want, because in a certain sense, all of Coover's themes are embedded everywhere. In the shuffling of the cards, one finds his interest in repetition, in the same unusual card story. We find that however the characters are situated, they're all the same. Anything can be said about any of them, depending on the order of the storytelling. It is saying something ultimately, it seems to me, that no matter how many quirks and eccentricities we may present, that as people we're stuck being people, that we're all caught in the same pack of cards, and that our stories are only different from one another depending upon the incidentals, the way the deck happens to be shuffled. Is that...
That's pretty good. I'll buy that. And it also has to do a little bit that not only with the way that all of us are like one another, but the way that all stories are sort of like one another, so that the shuffleable pack includes the shuffling of stories. They seem to be very different from one another and have very different beginnings, middles, and ends, but in fact, you can tot them up. There's a, as you were saying, that there's a moment at the end when when you're going to reshuffle the deck and start it again, when the king complains again once more, the tarts have once again been stolen, and he's got to find the thief, and the queen cautions him that this really isn't necessary, because she says that, but surely you know everything already, says the queen. I know nothing, cries the king. Round up the subjects and send them shuffling through here again. This is not over. Justice must be done. Well, have it your own way, sighs the queen. But when you are done, you will see that I am right.
Well, it also seems that in childhood, we're presented with a whole spectrum of stories, whether it's the, you know, the huge anthologies of the Grimm stories that they collected, or the great number of stories that Hans Christian Andersen wrote himself, whether it is stories of magic or stories of culture or stories about how to tie your shoe and buckle, that it seems as if we're setting out on a vast adventure full of magnificence. Then as we get a bit older and we read, say, comparative mythology, we're told that all these stories are the same story, variants of the same story, and that, in a sense, we're stuck, hero or peasant, in repetitions of an endless need to reiterate a symbolic scheme, which seems to be what your work is about as well.
Certainly it's very focused on this notion of reiteration and the notion, too, of the scheme. So when one examines one kind of, say, crippling structure, something that inhibits freedom of thought or freedom of expression just in the individual sense, one finds parallels in this through all cultures. So we speak to each other very easily on these themes. It's also true that finding our way out of the kind of thicket of tale-telling that we get, we do find a kind of tendency of deromanticization. And I think one of the secondary, perhaps not much talked about, consequences of literature or art in any form is it is a kind of romantic resistance to this gathering cynicism and despair. And it offers a modest sort of response to the losses you feel when your stories begin to disintegrate on you.
I thought that we would take a look at the first story in Robert Cooper's book, A Child Again, which is published by McSweeney's. It's Sir John Paper Returns to Anna Lee. And, you know, it's a story about the dragon of the song, Puff the Magic Dragon. But in Cooper's work, the story is aligned to everything we know about it. So among the myths about dragons that Cooper finds is that their treasures often include pearls. We'll be hearing more about Puff's hoard of pearls. And his friend, the little boy, Jackie Paper, has gotten older now. And, you know, Puff, lonely, caved, is still causing trembling on the island of Anna Lee. And Jackie Paper is too old to go back, and he doesn't want to vanquish Puff. They were friends. What is he going to do? Even domesticating him seems to be an inferior choice. And so the story is about, in a sense, what you do with the imagination when, in a sense, you're too old for it. It hasn't defeated you yet. You're still in love with the tales of adventure of your childhood, but you know you don't have the heart for them, and you know that they're not true. So here's Robert Cooper reading a section from Sir John Paper Returns to Anna Lee.
Puff's poor cave is dark and gloomy, but it is not entirely lightless. Anna Lee's seaside mist seeps in by day, coiling into penumbral corners, pressing its damp, purgatorial murk into the cave's soft walls. Puff vaguely associates this invasion with life. Less reassuring is the terrible nighttime pallor of his treasure store of pearls, those teardrops from the moon, as old sailors would have it, thunderballs, lotus jewels. Their lurid glow lights up nothing but themselves, causing the barren walls dimly defined by day to recede by pearl light into a vast cosmic night. In all this desolation, Puff sometimes buries himself in his starry pearls like a galactic black hole haloed by a lightless light, dreaming of the death denied him and waiting for day to roll mistily in again and snuff out his treasure store's illusory omens. On the Nature of Black Holes. Black holes are the seductive dragons of the universe, outwardly quiescent yet violent at the heart, uncanny, hostile, primeval, emitting a negative radiance that draws all toward them, gobbling up all who come too close. Once having entered the tumultuous orbit of a black hole, nothing can break away from its passionate but fatal embrace. Though eons of teasing play may be granted the doomed, ultimately play turns to prey, and all are sucked haplessly, brilliantly aglow, true, but oh so briefly so, into the fire-breathing maw of oblivion. Black holes, which have no memory, are said to contain the earliest memories of the universe, and the most recent too, while at the same time obliterating all memory by obliterating all its embodiments. Such paradoxes characterize these strange galactic monsters, for whom creation is destruction, death, life, chaos, order, and darkness, illumination. For as dragons are also called worms, so black holes are known as wormholes, offering a mystical and intimate pathway to the farthest reaches of the cosmos, thus bringing light even as they consume it. Sir John Paper is delivering an encomium on those splendid particularities of the horse, often overlooked or even maligned, such as its tail, its teeth, the golden products of its digestive system, its soft jaws and rising withers, its exuberant sexual behavior, its whinny and its snorts, expression, when he receives, delivered by hand to the podium, news of the latest depredations by the dragon of Honalee, and the open call to all heroes for its severed head, the reward being half the dragon's hidden treasure, said to be worth more than the world is worth. Sir Jack pauses in his oration to contemplate this challenge, which is not the same for him as it is for others. Other heroes might be willing to risk their lives in an attempt to kill the dragon and win the treasure, but Sir Jack has no use for further wealth and would be loath to behead his childhood friend and first mount, or even to learn of his beheading. Moreover, it runs counter to his oft-expressed love for wild things, however remote he's become from them. So, what is to be done? Puff's appetite for violence must be, being irrepressible, desire is sacred, somehow transcended, which is something only he, Sir John Paper, can even hope to accomplish. There's an ancient Chinese saying that in heaven a horse is made into a dragon, and among men a dragon is made into a horse. Well, that is what he must do. He must make Puff into a horse. Before other heroes get there and make him into a scatter of grisly museum exhibits, he gazes out upon his audience, recalling that green-scaled rascal and the soft, pearly light of his cave, and wondering where he was in his interrupted oration. Something about beautiful body parts, a favorite theme. Dragons, he says at last, have the outward appearance of giant lizards or crested snakes with the jaws of crocodiles, the head and forelegs of lions, the talons of eagles and hawks, the bellies of clams, souls of tigers, and ears of cows. But they have the heart of a horse. Puff's pearls lie spilled about, heaped up here and there, some stuffed into fat brown sacks, others embedded in the cave walls like drops of some luminous ooze. Beautiful pearls, the wan luster of moons, a nebulous pallor of breath and autumn mist, of semen, milk, and cowrie shells, of bones, the white of the eye, parchment. Come back, Jackie Paper, the pearls in the walls would read if Puff could spell. But he cannot, so they resemble instead in their random scatter the night sky under which he and Jackie once roamed the high seas. Puff wears a pearl tucked in his chin, sucks another beneath his tongue. For pearls are the quintessential givers of life, more powerful even than mandrake root or sweet basil or beautiful maidens. Though when he eats them, unlike basil or maidens, they just pass through, untransfigured, which might cause others to doubt their marvelous qualities, but not Puff. Volatile as he is also a creature of habit and simple beliefs. He has been sucking pearls for ages, and not to do so would cause him to doubt that he was who he was. The pearl, an emblem of beauty, of fidelity and humility, sign of self-sacrifice and sorrow, of innocence, integrity, purity, rarity, tears, and vaginal dew, of virginity and wealth and of wisdom. Powdered pearl in lemon juice cures lunacy, gut ache, and epilepsy. It's an attribute of moon goddesses, Christ, cows, pudenda, and the Virgin Mary. Is used in all Eastern love potions and protects chastity in the West. Pigafetta, traveling with Magellan, reported that the king of Borneo dropped his pants and showed him two as large as goose eggs. The pearl is a Christian symbol of salvation and a particle of the consecrated Eucharist wafer, the spiritual essence of the universe for the Chinese, and a charm against fire and the Muslim condition of the hereafter. The faithful endure forever, encapsulated in pearls, each with his own exquisite virgin, Allah's wages to the Orthodox. A pearl suspended in the belly of the sea monster that swallowed Jonah provided him light to read by, and among the holy creatures proposed for beatification are the oysters that provided the pearls for the heavenly entranceway, also known as the Pearly Gates. The Chinese in the 6th century believed it rained pearls when dragons fought in the sky, but some beliefs are not true. We know now, in fact, that such storms are more often triggered by sudden eclipses in the erogenous zones of quasars. Sir Jack has told us so. When Sir John Paper's departure is announced, his peers caution him against so rash and, well, so unseemly an undertaking. Surely he is past all that. His days of manly glory now well behind him, time to rest on one's laurels, reap one's rewards, etc. The very conventionality of their advice confirms for him the rightness of his decision. He has had to have some of his knightly apparel let out, as they say, but he feels as fit as ever. Even his chronic aches and pains, his athlete's foot, hemorrhoids, and back spasms seem to have faded into the background at the prospect of this new quest.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We've been listening to Robert Coover read a section of the first story, In a Child Again, Sir John Paper Returns to Anna Lee. It's from A Child Again, published by McSweeney's. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Robert Coover about A Child Again. Now, there it is. As the story continues, the aged knight is going to discover the unlikelihood of his ability, really, to ride Puff again. Puff may be as young as ever. He's the imagination. But the body of the knight can't sustain it. And in this very first story, we're being beckoned back to Anna Lee, the place where mists allow its visitors to know better what's not there than what is. A perfect figure for the imagination. And so the book begins in a kind of sadness, disillusion, that's going to be followed in story after story. And these are going to be joined by figures from later kinds of experience, men being shot against the wall by political enemies, and a logic puzzle about who's standing next to who. All sorts of ways that logic allows us to delay the inevitable sadness. And the story seems to be organized by a logic that asks, how do I get all of this material into as compact a space imaginable? The story seems to be about the triumph of art over space.
Or over time, either way, doesn't matter. It's a continuum, as they tell us. I would say it's a kind of recognition of reality. I think of myself as a realist, often misunderstood in that regard. And yet a kind of romantic determination to make the best of it in some way. So in my way of making the best of it is to try to make the story, make a good story out of it, make it, if poignantly so, still funny and provocative. So, the one thing about Sir John Paper is that the poor old fellow's had it. He knows he's had it, but he's still crawling back up on Puff's back again. And that willingness to do that, to get right back up there on Puff's back again, is part of what makes the writing of the stories possible. If one falls into the despair that's available as one's story supports fall away, it's all too easy to sink into what I think Jack Barth called in the second novel, cosmopsis, I think it was his word for it, that feeling of total inertia that overtakes you when you realize looking at the world as a whole is from a cosmic viewpoint, it's meaningless and it can just drive you into a kind of immobility. And it's, you know, breaking through that immobility and getting right back on the horse again that is the heroism and is the only way that we might, you know, make something out of nothing.
Now, always at the opposite pole of the storytelling, there's a sense that in the meeting of stories and legends and facts, that the welter may lead to a kind of transcendence, and that transcendence brings someone, the reader, the writer, the team of reader and writer, into the space of mysticism, which seems to be a kind of valorous space, although inevitably the mystic ends up with his head in the bucket too. But it does seem as if a certain kind of mysticism is appealing to you as it never was to Barth or to William Gass, who ultimately always insisted that the brutal unmeaningfulness of life brooked no transcendence.
Well, that could be. I haven't quite thought it that way. When I used the word just now and I was reading that part about Sir John Paper's desire to help Puff transcend his condition, I thought I was speaking with a kind of bitter irony, but it's possible that it's there. I know in both the Brunus book and the one I'm working on now, it's not a hostility to mysticism, but a constant questioning of it, because it can be an easy way out of whatever dilemma there's there. But I have experiences which are could be called transcendental moments, and these usually come about somehow through art, that something, just the sheer spectacular beauty of something, or the poignancy of it, or the intensity of emotion that's invested in it or delivered by it, bring about a sort of euphoria of a sort, a feeling that, oh, wow, this is so good. And these moments, they can happen in real life too, outside of art, but I find it most likely to find them there. These moments of just sheer pleasure, where you find such delight, are, I suppose, in some manner mystical moments, because they are a momentary denial of reality in order to kind of rise above and grasp something that's other than that real thing.
At first, people hearing about a new Coover book will say, oh, goody, he's doing pornography now, I can't wait, or he's doing fairy tales and legends. But we're not going to go to any easy parody of classic comics. That is in the mix, but that's not the point. The easy laugh at the betrayal that is involved in believing what you've been told in the nursery, which is, you know, something that people spend their whole lives trying to get over, unfortunately. Getting over the idea that the stories that you loved the most and that appealed first are the most untrue. Or, on the other hand, suggestions about a reality that you're not going to find on this plane and therefore frustrating. So here we are with these stories that are about that combination of pleasure and pain, and that resist any easy way of working. You know, that the stories are working to find how not to be easy.
Yes, I hope that's true. The almost all the stories, perhaps not 100% so here, but I tend to have a kind of respect and love of them, even as I confront them and disassemble them and consider alternative versions of them and break them open to see if there's anything in there that's bothersome to us. I do all of that. At the same time, it's partly out of respect of them that I'm there. You know, I wouldn't be in some sort of banality trying to do this. I'm dealing with even Little Red Riding Hood is full of, you know, profundities that kind of lie in wait for you once you start kind of butting in. So I don't know what word I would put in place of it. I suppose the word mysticism bothers me just a little bit, just because because it's attached to so much kind of forms of religious acceptance of the world. When you're not a religious person, you find a way to be saintly without necessarily believing in the tenets or something. And all that's a bit irritating to me, actually. So what I really am always attempting to do is, part of what is elevating, part of what is transcending, is that as you work with any of these tales, there's something about them that leads you above them yourself. It's even a surprise to you that there's something beautiful there you hadn't seen before, and that discovery of that beauty is if not a mystical moment, at least a moment of delight an expectation that goes with it that allows you to think, I'm going to have this experience again. I keep looking at stories and keep playing with them and keep driving through them and so on. And from time to time, I'm also going to kind of be lifted above them and feel something more in them than I had ever experienced before.
I've been speaking with Robert Coover, author most recently of A Child Again, a collection of stories published by McSweeney's. Thank you, Robert, for joining me.
It's been a pleasure, Michael. You're a great guy to talk with.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
In books, to the land of ice and snow, in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Funds books for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book. The mouse club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.